Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this episode of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Short History of War, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about how wars are brought to a conclusion.
The reasons why wars end is obviously at the present moment a topical question, becoming more topical because of our concern about Ukraine, but also a sense that there might well be a solution to the crisis, either in terms of an imposed peace or in terms, more hopefully, of a negotiated peace. And that naturally encourages people to think, how do wars as a whole end? And that's why on this series this week, we're talking about that. And if I might congratulate Graham Stewart, we were originally going to be talking about early Caribbean history by way of a different topic and with reference to my book, The History of the Caribbean. And he prevailed upon me to switch to this topic about 2 hours ago. So congratulations to him. Now, I think it's fair to say that why and how wars end, and this is not intended as an evasion, we're going to come to Ukraine more specifically, but why and how wars end in part is bound up with the question of what you assume a war to be and why you think wars begin, which are not quite the same question. Now, if we look at the first question, and I have tried to write about it in my book on the causes of war, but if you look at the first question, the idea, the sort of classical idea of a war between European states, shall we say, of the mid-19th century or the outcome of World War I, people mobilizing their armies, which meant essentially calling up reservists, declaring war, declaring a state of war with all the legal changes that incurred both domestically and internationally, and then at the very end of the war, agreeing a peace settlement in which, in the case of World War I, there would be an armistice at a specific moment, and then there would be a process of the negotiation of peace treaties. And most people in the West tend to assume that that's, as it were, what a war is, how a war starts, how a war ends. And therefore, if they were thinking about Ukraine, they would assume that at some moment there would be a peace conference. There would be first a armistice, then a peace conference, and then a peace. Well, I think it's fair to say that there are, of course, wars of that type, but such wars are exceptional. So let's try and offer a different typology of war. First of all, I think wars can be divided, and there are often overlaps between these, between wars that are civil wars, domestic wars, and wars that are international. Now, obviously, there are overlaps. And in the specific case of Ukraine, the overlap is in the case of the Donbass region, which is, as it were, in a state of civil war with Ukraine as a whole, but also receives active Russian military assistance. So, as with Crimea, that overlaps to an international war. Now, in domestic wars, you do not tend to have a formal process of declaration of war or of cessation of war. You do most clearly when there is a case that the, as it were, seceding state or one of the parties or both of the parties in a civil war are acting like a state with full state powers and a regular army. So you could see that process at the end of the American Civil War in 1865, when there were formal surrenders by American Confederate military units at Appomattox and so on. So you could actually argue there was a formal process of bringing the war to a close. That is not actually what tends to happen. What tends to happen in a civil war is there is an active breakdown, a period of breakdown in relations prior to full-scale conflict. Then there is conflict. It might be full-scale. It might be more limited. Then that goes on for a while. And then that conflict tends to peter out as one or other side is seen to be victorious and others are actually brutalized or compromised into surrender or participation in the new order. Now, it appears that that was the desideratum from the perspective of President Putin, that he wished to impose a new government in Ukraine, to throw out the government of President Zelensky, to put in a government that was a client state, rather like the government of Belarus. And then obviously there would have been a process of continuing civil war as those people who rejected that were brutalized into surrender or into being slaughtered. But that would have been presented not as war, but as a kind of police action, which is rather as the Chinese like to pretend the Russians are doing in Ukraine, and rather as one suspects the Chinese would try and do if they invaded and conquered Taiwan. In other words, arguing that it's a domestic matter, arguing that it is not a war and therefore that they are not obliged to respect international treaties on the conduct towards combatants, nor to accept the possibility of international arbitration or whatever else, peacekeeping, whatever else. So that's wars within states. Many more wars within states occur than is suggested by most of the literature on the history of war. And if you look at warfare in the last 30 years, and you look at states such as Côte d'Ivoire, Sudan, Central African Republic, Mali, Ethiopia, you will see high levels of intent. And those are by no means an exhaustive list. The most obvious example is Congo, but you will see high levels of intensity in lethality. And often these wars are considerably bloodier and more brutal and longer than what we tend to see as state-to-state wars, such as British intervention against Argentina, against the Argentine invasion, I should say, of the Falklands in 1982. If we are looking at wars between states, then again, the process by which a war ends is a complex one. Part of it, clearly, is a matter of the military arithmetic, the arithmetic of losses, the arithmetic of strength, the arithmetic of territory gained. And as we know, there have been no shortage of rather second-rate military commentators to come out. You know, it's hilarious to listen to British military commentators who, having buggered up Iraq and buggered up Afghanistan, I mean the British interventions there, now think they can tell us what ought to happen in Ukraine. If they were such marvellous analysts, they would have done better in the wars in which they'd taken command positions. But we'll leave that aside. So there is, on the one hand, the arithmetic of military success, failure, strength, and an ability to sustain the effort, or an apparent ability to sustain it. The latter one then moves into the question of perception, how the various combatants perceive both they are doing and perceive how their opponents are doing, and how they perceive the intentions of the other. Because clearly, if you perceive the intentions of the other as being anti-societal, in other words, slaughtering prisoners or murdering civilians, then you are likely to take a more adverse military outcome than if you don't perceive it in that light. And that's an obvious point, but one that possibly people underplay. And I think it's also worth saying that in an international scenario, and in the case of Ukraine, but Ukraine is not by any means unique or original. We can see conflicts like, for example, the current one in Ethiopia or the earlier one in Congo, in which international powers intervened, provided arms, also provided, particularly in the case of Congo, many powers came in and provide places like Angola, Rwanda, Zimbabwe, came in and provided troops. And there, of course, their perception of their interests and of what they feel would happen if others did well becomes a major factor. So one of the difficulties you've got here is you have to consider the question as to how far the war is one in which the combatants have a possibility of changing policy goals during the conflict, and therefore of varying the terms or conditions and context within which they might A, accept that there has to be an end of the war, B, determine a timetable for that, and C, negotiate on the terms, and D, a key point, implement the terms. And again, I think it's fair to say that those are fluid. Now, you can get a situation in which people try and impose a degree of certainty, as with the Allies after the Casablanca conference, in which they determined that there would be a demand for unconditional surrender, that that would be a fixed demand, that that would preclude negotiating with Germany or Japan, as it eventually became, and that in practical terms, that was an attempt to prevent the Soviet Union and Stalin making another deal with Hitler, as he had done in 39 and as he had sounded in both 42 and 43. Now, in the case of the current war in Ukraine, and indeed of the war in Ethiopia, it is clear that both sides obviously have differing goals, but it is also far from clear how far they are willing to negotiate on them. The assumption appears to be, from the indications offered in public, that the Ukrainian government is willing to confirm that it would not join NATO, which is not really surprising, because it's very unlikely that NATO would allow Ukraine to join, not least because it has an unsettled conflict with the Russian separatist areas. There is much less clarity on the willingness of Ukraine to accept a military and political agreement over the status of these breakaway areas and also over the status of Crimea. In the case of Russia, which appears to have truly made a very significant failure in the sense that it has united, maybe temporarily, but nevertheless united a lot of European attention against it, that it has put a lot of strain on its economy, that it's revealed a poor military performance, and that it is scarcely, in its murderous and illegal policy towards Ukrainians, it is scarcely going to endear itself to them. It is likely that Russia will have to moderate its goals. Now, the attraction from that point of view is that President Putin has never been very clear, other than in terms that are quite frankly ridiculous, you know, denazification of a non-Nazi country being just the most obvious. President Putin has not been very clear as to what his war goals are, and therefore hasn't committed himself too much to, as it were, what he might see as unnegotiable. But the reality is that until President Putin accepts that there has been a political verdict, both a political verdict in terms of the resolve of the Ukrainian people, a political verdict in terms of the resolve in particular of Eastern Europeans and their unwillingness to be intimidated, and I suspect also a political verdict in terms of a determination not to be intimidated by Russian military strength, which, as with often when you use military strength, has been shown to be a wasting asset. Until President Putin thinks through adequately the implications of that, we may find it difficult to get the end of that particular war. Having said that, and despite the appalling brutality of the Russians, this actually is a war where you can see some basis of compromise being possible. There are many other wars in the world where that is less easy to see. The rivalry between Iran and Israel in the Middle East, the expansionism of China towards Taiwan, but also more generally in the Asia-Pacific area, the narcissistic, paranoid aggression of North Korea. All of these are issues in which it's harder to see how compromise can be arrived at once war starts. And therefore, they are even more significant, in my view, that deterrence prior to any outbreak of war should be hard-edged and should show a determination to fight in order to preclude a war which it might be difficult to end.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Black, for introducing these themes. I want to start specifically with the situation in Ukraine at the moment. Zelensky, in his deliberations on what might be areas where concessions can be made, is obviously also in contact with Ukraine's main military suppliers, United States, America, so United States, Britain, and so on. And that gives them a certain leverage over what Zelensky does. Putin seems to be much more in a position where fewer other powers have leverage on him, unless there are dealings coming from Beijing that we can only speculate about. Does that make things clearer for Putin in that sense, in that he's not fighting with the help of allies?
Well, I think that's a fascinating question, Graham. I mean, in a way, as you correctly say, he's not got an alliance structure, but I think it's fair to say that in most wars, you have allies, opponents, and neutrals. And the problem for him is that in this particular struggle, the number of neutrals in the European space has been much less than he might have anticipated. He might well have anticipated that European powers that have left-wing governments would not have been willing to support a NATO or EU stance on Ukraine. And indeed, there are some European governments, Cyprus and Malta being obvious instances, which are in effect Russian client states, whatever people might like to think about them. Where I think President Putin has possibly done better than we might be comfortable to think about is that although they aren't formally allied to Russia, India, Pakistan, Brazil, and South Africa have all shown, and that is by no means an exhaustive list, have all shown an unwillingness to defend international law, even by admonition, let alone doing anything. And that is, in a sense, encouraging for Russia and worrying for the West. And I think we need to be much more hard-edged. I cannot see the point with nuclear powers which have the money to spend on nuclear arms, such as India and Pakistan, of us giving humanitarian aid to them when they follow a policy in international relations which is giving countenance to illegality and brutality. And I believe that we need to think carefully about sanctioning them in some respects as much as we think about sanctioning others. Now, as far as Putin's room for maneuver, all autocracies are more complex internally than they appear from outside. And there will be complex relationships vis-a-vis the military and vis-a-vis the security services and the paramilitary. The paramilitary probably being the most important in this area, just as paramilitaries, things like Republican Guards, are very significant and have been very, or National Guards have very been significant or very significant in the past in states like Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. So in answer to your question, Putin has room for manoeuvre as long as things go well. If things go badly, the equations of power within his autocracy will be under strain. And the same thing obviously would be the case if there was an unsuccessful Chinese invasion of Taiwan or an unsuccessful North Korean strike war against Japan or South Korea.
I think what makes the Ukrainian situation difficult in terms of how it may end is that what Zelensky can offer is not what Putin claims to want, by which I mean there's an asymmetry. I mean, potentially Zelensky can make offers about things of which he has already effectively lost control, not joining NATO, ceding Crimea. Well, it's effectively part of de facto Russia in any case, perhaps allowing plebiscites in the disputed areas around Donbass. These are concrete steps that can be made in a negotiation. It's not very clear from Putin's perspective what he can negotiate on, given that he already accepts these things. And, you know, his reason for going to war is rather fantastical, which is essentially the elimination of Ukraine as a separate state whilst it's denazified, in his words.
Yes, that's his headline ambition, but that doesn't mean that he won't be prepared possibly to settle for something else, not least in light of political, military and fiscal equations. So, I mean, in many senses, he's not committed himself to an enormous amount, because if Ukraine announces that it's not going to join NATO, he can then say to his supporters, well, see, we stopped that, we protected Russia, there are a few Nazis, this is inaccurate, but there are a few Nazis in Ukraine, but they're now toothless. We have succeeded and achieved our goals. And because it is a autocracy with a state propaganda, it's the sort of place where, I mean, think of the BBC on steroids in terms of a left-wing agenda, and Jeremy Corbyn as prime minister. You can actually propagate the most ludicrous notions and people will believe them, or they'll just mutter. So it's possible that Putin, even if recognizably in the outside world he has failed, will actually be prepared to accept a compromise peace in which he then proclaims as a success. I suspect the situation is harder for the Ukrainians, because it is the Ukrainians who have been brutalized, who've seen civilians murdered, their cities desecrated, all the rules of law broken. I think the only thing the Russians haven't done is cannibalism. I think everything else that they could have done to break the laws of war, they've done. Given that this is the case, I think that it's going to be harder, and actually probably would be an enormous demand on the statesmanship of the current Ukrainian government to be able to persuade its population to accept a peace which President Putin will then crow he's won. But, you know, that's what the end of wars are like. Compromise, and compromise tends to be unpopular. Very few wars end like World War II.
Yes, I wonder if there's an analogy. I wonder if President Zelensky, if he's got a moment to consider historical analogies, I wonder whether the Franco-Prussian War is in his mind, which ended obviously with Alsace-Lorraine being ceded to Germany. But France got out of the war. Is that a helpful analogy or too flawed?
It's a possible analogy. And in terms of international law and brutality, the Prussians, the Germans, had shelled Paris, inflicting a lot of damage. They'd, murdered a lot of civilians, accusing them of being guerrillas, irregular fighters. You know, they've generally behaved very badly. But I mean, what's the interesting aspect of that was it left Germany with a permanent problem on its western frontier. And in the case of President Putin, I mean, you know, if you lose a war, let's say, I mean, we lost the war in Iraq, and obviously that was a balls up and it was done terribly, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, although unfortunately a large number of people died, ultimately it does not have the weight on British consciousness as if we'd engaged in war with the Republic of Ireland and lost. And I think that one of the difficulties is when you have a war with immediate neighbours and it ends with a compromise peace, that then becomes a very difficult circumstance to police, as it were, not least that I suspect on both sides there will be a searching out of those people who are held rightly or wrongly, and it will be both rightly and wrongly, depending upon which case you're looking at, to be people who were helpful to the others.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how things have been changed by the increasing recourse to appeals to international law.
In what sense?
Sorry, in the sense of the role of the United Nations, in the also separately from that, the efforts to find ways of charging Putin with crimes against humanity, war crimes. You know, Russia isn't a member of the ICC, but efforts to make sure that he can never travel to a country that is a member of the ICC for fear he might be charged, or even a charge of starting a war of aggression. Does that make things more difficult to reach a settlement in the sense it puts his back up against the wall and it doesn't give him a way out?
Well, yes, you're probably right. I mean, as you may know, I've written extensively on both World War II and World War I, and also a book on strategy. And one of the points I made in my book of strategy is that you need, if you're defeating somebody, to leave a government in place to surrender to you, because that delegitimates continuing opposition and hostility. So one of the key points about World War II is that what happened afterwards, and that is that there was no continuing German or Japanese resistance. And that was because what were vicious regimes had actually formally surrendered. Hitler's designated successor as head of the Nazi Party, as Chancellor of Germany, and as head of the armed forces, Admiral Dönitz, surrendered. And that obviously delegitimated continued opposition. Same with Japan. Now, we saw in Iraq in 2003, the problem, if you don't leave somebody in place or construct somebody in place to formally surrender. In the case of Russia, which is a different scenario, they don't need to surrender. But if you want to persuade somebody to compromise, you have to give up the idea that you could treat them in accordance with some naive textbook drawn up by some wet behind the ears professor of international law.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the efforts in the Second World War of the Allies to go for unconditional surrender, obviously it was useful in continuing to bond them together and to reduce Stalin's fears about what the Western Allies might do. But it also struck me that Hitler was the sort of personality for whom everything was either unconditional surrender or unconditional success or victory on his terms. Hitler was never a man who was going to negotiate a reasonable peace. I wonder, compared to the Kaiser in the First World War, 1917, Lord Lansdowne famously wrote a letter published in the newspapers and the Telegraph, I think, arguing for negotiated peace. I mean, where might that have gone had the British government have picked up on the initiative? What was there?
Well, there were several interesting things. Let's start with World War II. In World War II, unconditional surrender, you know, as you know, there's people play through all the counterfactuals, and you'll know I've written a book on counterfactual history. And the standard counterfactual is, if the Western Allies hadn't insisted on unconditional surrender, would elements within the Wehrmacht and or the German government, the Nazi government, have been more inclined to ditch Hitler and to do a deal with the West? And the answer is, I don't know. But that's a hypothetical that has been played with. As you correctly say, it was an attempt to anchor Stalin, who quite frankly was totally untrustworthy. Of the three powers, I mean, it's hilarious that you get historians banging on against Western appeasement. Of Britain, America, and the Soviet Union, it of course was the Soviet Union that in 1939 had signed a treaty with Hitler, which it maintained till 1941. Now, and you know, the effects of the war, let's be clear about this, we're talking about Ukraine at the present moment. Ukraine, as with areas like Poland and the Baltic Republics, was brutalized by the Germans. And it's better to use the term Germans than Nazis, because many of the bastards were people who weren't members of the Nazi Party. It was brutalized by the Germans, but it also then needs to be remembered, it was then brutalized by the Soviets when they came through. So, and indeed, in areas such as the Baltic Republics and Eastern Poland, prior to the German invasion, the Soviets had already been murdering lots of people. So you could argue that Putin's policies are in line with those of Stalin in terms of having no interest in any legal constraint on the brutality of the regime. As I said, the only thing I think they haven't done is cannibalism, although I'm quite happy to be corrected if I'm wrong. Now, as far as World War I is concerned, there's recently been a book which has argued that there was a opportunity to negotiate peace at the height of the war. I think, this is a complex matter, but to my reading, and again, there's a book by me on World War I, but to my reading, although there were important peace feelers, particularly the Pope trying to arrange one between France, Italy, and Austria, because he didn't like Catholics fighting each other, and he was concerned about what would happen. But as you may know, this peace feeler was, as it were, the Germans sat on the Austrians to disavow it. And I think it's fair to say that German policy from 1916 onwards becomes more aggressive in its goals and means. And thinking of means, you can think about deliberately resuming unrestricted submarine warfare in the beginning of 1917, even though they knew that would bring America into the war. You can think of large-scale Goethe bomber offensive against Britain in 1917. You can think of the effective military dictatorship of Ludendorff and Hindenburg after they replaced Falkenhayn. Now, if you think that that military group would have relatively readily allowed itself to be displaced in order to further civilian peacemakers, that's fine. I just don't see it in that light, and I don't think it makes a credible account of a German military, which at that stage was not willing to accept that it hadn't won. And remember, to go back to a status quo ante bellum, which is often the basis of a compromise peace, would have meant Germany withdrawing from the most of Belgium, which it had conquered, from parts of France, and if the Allies had been insistent, from those large areas of Poland it had conquered, Russian Poland, and indeed from Serbia. I cannot see the German military accepting that at that point, because they still had hopes of winning. They changed their policies in late 1918 because they no longer had hopes of winning. And that was because of the brilliant success of the Allied armies on the Western Front, particularly the British and their Dominion allies, notably the Canadians, but also others, particularly the French and also very much the Americans. And that was a great military achievement. Germany had knocked out Russia, which of course had been undermined by the Bolsheviks, but was defeated on the Western Front. And that forced it to peace, even though it was still in occupation of much of Belgium and indeed large areas of Eastern Europe and Serbia. So I think one of my great complaints, as you may know, is that so much of the literature about World War I has been written, as in the literature about the causes of the war. You can see the rather poor book by Christopher Clark called Sleepwalkers. People have focused on what the diplomats were saying. Actually, they need to focus much more on what the military were doing. And I think that remains the case throughout the war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, a final question, if I may. Which are the historical precedents for ending wars that President Zelensky and Putin would do well to study?
I have no idea. I don't believe that you could. No, Graham. I mean, what you get is a lot of glib historians on the radio, on the television, writing commentary pieces. And what a surprise, what they know about becomes the key issue that should be understood and their view of it in order to think about the modern world. Having written quite widely myself, what I can tell you is that history is non-linear. No case automatically repeats itself. Every case is specific rather than generic, and one has to be very wary. History is complex, and one of the difficult and important. Now, what you've had in this crisis is very interestingly a highly significant historical reading of the situation, namely that by President Putin, which of course is deeply flawed. And I've written in the past about, history wars, etc. And there are several books by me on those. Why should I similarly offer you a flawed analysis just because it sounds good? There is no an automatic reading, but the key thing I would say is that if you are looking at an end to a conflict, and it is in the interests of both sides to end this conflict, if you are looking at an end, you need not only compromise in purposes, but you also need to have compromise in means. And proposing to try one side for war crimes, however we might feel it deserved, is not generally the way to get a compromise peace.
Well, that's a very clear message to end on, Professor Jeremy Black, for taking us through how wars end. Thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.